she inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. Thanks so much for joining us and for being a part of Mrs. Green's World, and a big thanks to the sponsor of this show, the Chapman Automotive Group. They are indeed committed to doing their share and showing they care about our community and our planet. Their Honda dealership in our community just won one of five presidential awards for outstanding service and for sustainability efforts. So they are committed to our planet indeed. And for more information and to find a great green fuel-efficient car, please visit them at ChapmanTucson.com and be sure to tell them Mrs. Green sent you. We have to get that in there. Anyway, I hope that you are all ready for another amazing and important show for this next hour, because it impacts all of our lives. Every single listener, it impacts you. Have you ever asked yourself any of these questions? Who made my clothes? Where were they made? What did it take to make all these pretty colors? How can this t-shirt be so inexpensive? And how can I find out the answers to some of my questions about my clothing? Is there a source, or are there sources that I can trust? Well, the answer is yes to all of those. And I am quite certain that our guest today, Carrie Summers, can answer all of these and many more. Carrie is the founder and global operations director for Fashion Revolution. I love it. Fashion Revolution is based in the UK and is a not-for-profit community interest company, which I'm very interested to learn exactly what that is in that structure across the ocean. The community of Fashion Revolution is, well, it's quite inclusive and quite large. The more I dug, the more I went down the rabbit hole. It is everyone involved in the fashion supply chain, including, but not limited to, are you ready for this? Farmers, producers, buyers, designers, retailers, and consumers. They've got it covered, trust me. Carrie, thanks so much for joining us and for all you're doing to lead this global fashion revolution. We so need it, and you're helping to bring the message about much-needed change to the masses. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm delighted to be here to talk to you today.
I said to you off air, we had 1 minute to briefly talk, and I said I've interviewed over 500 guests, all of whom I have enjoyed, learned from, gotten excited about, but this is one so near and dear to my heart. And maybe it's because I was, you know, kind of late to the party and didn't realize the impact on our planet that the fashion industry has in every way, all of those sectors that we just mentioned. So I'm going to make this show all about you. I have more questions than we'll ever get time to. Last night I was up preparing and I was writing, oh, I have to ask her this. Oh, there's one more. Oh, how does she handle that? So I'm going to get everything I can out of you so that we can share this amazing and important message. So let's start with, is there a way to actually describe what the fashion revolution, what fashion revolution is to our listeners, and both the complexity and importance of all it represents? I know that's a multifaceted question, but it's probably not the first time you've been asked.
No, it's not. I mean, fashion revolution was born in the wake of the Rana Plaza disaster in Bangladesh, and we knew that, you know, 1,138 people was too many people to lose from the planet as a result of our insatiable appetite for fashion without that leading to revolutionary change. And we could see, you know, I could see so much momentum for a more ethical garment industry. And I think in the days after the disaster, when I was looking around, all the newspaper articles were saying, well, this is why we need more ethics, this is why we also need more traceability in the fashion industry. And, you know, it was just when I was having a bath a couple of days later, and the idea for fashion revolution, I mean, literally hit me. And it seemed like a good enough idea to get out of the bath and do something about it. And, you know, Fashion Revolution now, from that little sort of germ of an idea, has spread into a global movement in 100 countries around the world.
It's unreal.
So really, it's amazing. And, you know, we knew from the outset that what we had to tackle was, you know, the fact that the industry is very opaque. Nobody really knows who makes our clothes. And, you know, we saw this after the Rana Plaza disaster, when activist campaigners had to search through the rubble looking for the labels to prove which brands were actually making there. And I think a lot of people looked at that and thought, oh, well, the brands just aren't wanting to admit it. But the brands genuinely didn't know. They didn't know the factories where their clothes were being sewn together. And so, you know, we knew that the first thing we had to address was transparency, because you can't start to tackle those other social and environmental issues until you can actually see them.
Right. So that's a stepping off point, because why do we need it? You found out a lot of things. I really want to talk about transparency and the index that you developed, which was rather daunting. You see some of your, you know, your brands on there and you're like, ugh. So we'll get to that. I don't want to jump around, because I want to try to be a little bit sequential, as excited as I am. So in this day and age, transparency really matters. And where does it start? So, like, where do you look at this big, huge supply chain from the farmer up to the retailer? Where do you just start with the manufacturer? Do you start with the, you know, where do you start to talk about transparency? It's a big, big, comprehensive bear to take on.
It is. It's huge. And I think that's why we've got to tackle it. You know, as the saying goes, you know, you've got to eat the elephant in bite-sized chunks. And you've got to find ways to make it manageable. And we've got to tackle it from, you know, the consumer angle and make the consumers demand that brands become more transparent. We've got to tackle it through legislation and policy issues. So starting to legislate so that brands have to be responsible for their entire supply chains, but then also to encourage the brands. And in a way, that's what the Transparency Index does. You know, it's a bit of competition between the brands, and the brands who, you know, performed really poorly last year have certainly, you know, a lot of them have improved. And we're hoping that, you know, this year it will provide a baseline, and we'll see brands wanting to improve their score and become more transparent every year. So we've really got to tackle it from so many different angles.
And you did, and we will absolutely get into that, because I was looking at, I mean, I was like, click, 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 going down the rabbit hole, as I say. Let's talk about impact, and just let's focus for a minute on 2016. It was a very big year for Fashion Revolution. You had your loudest and strongest campaign. We got excited about it here, ever during Fashion Revolution Week. So what is it, when is it, and what kind of impact did you have?
Well, we're still sort of starting to look at our impact for this year, because, of course, Fashion Revolution Week was only a couple of couple of weeks ago. So we haven't got all of our facts and figures together. We know that, you know, a lot of our impact was up 100, 150%. We certainly haven't sort of got all of the figures together at the moment. But, you know, certainly by far and away our loudest year to date. We've I've been looking at the I Made Your Clothes post, so looking at the producers responding. And, you know, we've already seen, you know, probably at least, I'd say, twice, if not three times as many, you know, producers around the world, manufacturers, people showing us, I made your clothes. And whether that's small, you know, knitwear producer groups high up in the Andes in Peru, or whether that's bigger brands like, you know, Monsoon and Fat Face, G-Star, brands like that who have joined in, Zara, Massimo Dutti, Pull and Bear, who have actually answered customers' questions and responded to help them trace where their clothes come from. So, yeah, we've certainly seen a lot more impact, but it takes us quite a long time to actually, you know, analyse all of that impact and work out how many of those brands are big global brands, how many of them are mainstream, how many of them are, you know, smaller local ethical brands. So that's part of the process we're working on at the moment. But, you know, certainly hugely impactful this year. A lot more people asking that question, who made my clothes? And we're really starting to see brands, you know, answering and taking notice.
And you say that I love the website because it's not a lot of pictures, but the wording makes you want to just jump in and find out, how do I join the movement? You believe that fashion should feel good. Go into that a little bit more. What do you mean when you say that?
Well, I think you want to feel good, not just about buying, you know, a beautiful piece of clothing, a piece of clothing that hopefully is going to last, but you want to feel good about the impact of your purchase as well. I mean, if you actually start to think about it, you know, you don't want to know that piece of clothing was made by somebody whose life is potentially in danger. I mean, just jumping onto the Garment Worker Diaries, which is one of the projects we're working on at the moment, and we found that 40% of the garment workers we surveyed in India, Bangladesh and Cambodia had seen a fire in their place of work. I mean, 40% is an incredibly high statistic, and this is the kind of conditions that people are experiencing to show, you know, to make the clothes that we want to wear. So I think people, you know, they want to feel good about what they're buying, and they want to know that they're doing good through buying something as well, and not in a really sort of, you know, crunchy way. They still want to buy something that's beautiful, they still want to buy something that's mainstream, but they want something which also, you know, meets their, you know, their ethical criteria, you know, at least so they know that people haven't suffered, that animals haven't suffered, that the environment hasn't been abused in the process of making that garment.
And, you know,
and that really should be possible.
Yes. And another thing, kind of a reflection on my part, is the message everywhere on your website is not about shame, blame, and guilt. It's about hope. It's about excitement. It's about igniting radical changes. So I felt as though you're leading us to something, not let's beat up the bad guys, but let's talk about safe, clean, and fair, and doing things in a very different way. Let's talk for a second. I kind of love this, and people laugh at me because I'm 66 years old, and I'll say, you know, hashtag don't bother me or hashtag I love that. You really did, I believe, helped ignite a global conversation about things like supply chains by the hashtag who made my clothes. Is that an oversimplification, or was that a big part of it, the social media revolution?
Yeah, I think the social media has been a huge part of it. I mean, just to get an idea of the impact, I heard after the first year from an industry insider who works with a lot of the big brands that for every one person who asked that question, who made my clothes, they were taking it as representing 100,000 people
wow.
who thought the same way but couldn't be bothered to do anything about it. So I think that shows the power we have as consumers. And you know, a lot of brands have been quite shocked at just the sheer number of people asking that question, who made my clothes? You know, when we were doing some of the research for the Fashion Transparency Index, we were looking through all of brands, you know, sort of websites, and, you know, some of them in their frequently asked questions have, you know, what are you doing on Fashion Revolution Week? How are you answering the question, who made my clothes? And it's great that that's making it into brands' FAQs. You know, some brands actually have a whole page dedicated to Fashion Revolution and, you know, answering the question, who made my clothes now? And we're seeing, you know, more and more brands making their supply chains transparent. So, you know, it really shows the positive impact. I think the one example I'll give is Gap. And after the first Fashion Revolution Day in 2014, Gap said, you know, we're not disclosing this information. This is proprietary information. We're not telling you who made my clothes. And then in the past 12 months, they've published their first tier factory list. So that's the places where their clothes are sewn together. And, you know, that is a direct result of pressure. They know that their customers are interested. So many people are asking Gap, who made my clothes? And so they've done that for, you know, Gap, Old Navy, Banana Republic. And a lot of the brands who have published their first tier factory list are then going on and they're looking at, you know, starting to publish, or at least doing the research as to where, you know, where do their textiles come from? Where are they dyed? Where are they laundered? And so we are starting to see, I mean, 14 out of the 100 brands in our transparency index had published some or all of their second tier factories as well. But it starts to get a lot murkier when you get down to the raw materials. But, you know, brands really are changing. Consumer pressure really does work, but you've got to engage consumers. You've got to engage the fashion lovers. And like you were saying on our website, it's all very very positive, and inclusive and positive were the two words we came up with in our very first meeting. And we really adhered to those all along. We want to engage people who love fashion but haven't thought about the rest of the story at all. You know, we want people to feel good about asking brands the question, asking shop assistants the question. You know, it's not about tying yourself to the railings. It's not about going out with a loudspeaker. It's about doing something that everybody can do. And, you know, they can hold the brands accountable, the brands, you know, the retailers where they love to shop.
And I've been connected with a woman named Sass Brown from the Fashion Institute of Technology in mm-hmm. New York City, and watching some of the amazing things she's done. Overall, how's the United States showing up for this? And I understand that a lot of what happens doesn't happen here. What happens here is people buy the clothes. There's not a lot of clothing manufacturing. You know what I mean? The beat goes on. So is the United States in the fashion industry, are they participating in a big way, or do we need to rattle that cage some more? Because we are major consumers.
Yes, you are major consumers, and we definitely do need to rattle that cage more, as you say. I mean, I think it's been harder to get fashion revolution going in the States. I think partly because maybe in Europe, you know, ethical and sustainable fashion has become very mainstream. You know, and people know that you can buy really, really great clothing, which is sustainable. Whereas in the States, you know, there's still a bit more of a division, and people still, you know, my impression seems to be that people still think that, you know, if you buy something ethical, it might not be as fashion forward as some other clothing. And that really, really isn't true. You know, there's some amazing brands who are working in the US, like Everlane, like Zadie, you know, a lot of brands, Reformation, and people who are making, you know, some really, really great clothing. So I think we just, you know, it's also such a vast country as well, so we almost need to sort of split the country down a bit and have some different coordinators. but we've certainly noticed that the engagement in the US has gone up this year. There's a lot more events happening all around the States, you know, some pretty big conversations. Some of them were online. There was a lot of physical events happening, you know, either in small retailers or some, you know, some bigger events. So, you know, it certainly to me seemed like the US was really starting to gain some momentum this year. So hopefully next year, for year five, we'll really start to see fashion revolution becoming more mainstream in the States and more consumers involved.
And that's, you know, that gives me a lot of hope. We interviewed the chief sustainability officer for Eileen Fisher, and it was a wonderful interview on many levels because she talked about some of the metrics that they set out, the goals that they wanted to achieve and timelines. And she said, I'll be perfectly honest, they were rigorous. They were really, that's what we wanted to do. And we are going to have a hard time really meeting those because of the challenges that we faced, even in terms mm-hmm. of manufacturing in the United States. She said it still isn't easy to get things manufactured in the United States. And I guess I have a question about where does the conversation around fast fashion fit into this? Because one of the things I see in the United States are we have an egregious amount of stores that I say the five-time wash stores, because you wash these clothes five times and they fall apart. They're horribly made. They're, I'm 100% sure, not sustainably sourced. And young kids, young people who are on budgets can go in there and buy, you know, spend $100 and get five items because yeah. they're $19 a piece. And, you know, 3 months later, they'll have to spend another $100. So the sad thing about this is that we are going to a break. That's how fast the time goes. So take a deep breath, please, Carrie. And when we get back, we'll talk about fast fashion and the impact and so many more things, because I would like to talk a little bit more about the metrics you had for 2016 and the kind of engagement you had, and a little bit about 17. We have so many things to talk about. So everybody, please stay here with me. We're talking with Carrie Summers, who is the founder and global operations director for Fashion Revolution. We're going to take a quick break. And I forgot to mention, I think, that we're talking to you in the UK. It sounds like you're next door. Everybody stay here with me. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
And welcome back, everybody. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thank you for being a part of it. We are spending this hour with Carrie Summers. Carrie is the founder and global operations director for Fashion Revolution. The mission of Fashion Revolution is quite comprehensive and extremely laudable. They want to unite people and organizations to work together towards radically changing the way our clothes are sourced, produced, and consumed so that our clothing is made in a safe, clean, and fair way. They believe that collaborating across the whole value chain from farmer to consumer is the only way to transform the industry. In short, their mission is to bring everyone together to make that happen. Carrie, thanks for being here. It's an exciting show and so hopeful about the future.
Good, yes, yes. And there, you know, there is a lot of hope as well. You know, we are seeing brands transforming. And, you know, I've certainly got a lot of hope that the industry can change. I mean, it's not going to be a fast process, but it's, you know, it certainly is changing.
It's changing. So let's remember, I'm going to circle back to fast fashion. And two parts to the question, is that one of the causes for the, you know, the devastating information that you read about the pollution and the water use and the exposure of toxins to the workers? So fast fashion is one piece of it. And I'm interested to hear, I mean, I lived in Germany for a couple of years, and it's a very different mindset there. People are not into more and bigger closets and on and on. So how does it differ? So fast fashion, and then how does it differ, you know, in Europe versus the United States?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely going to be a really long journey, and there's going to be lots of incremental but necessary steps to start to turn the tide of fast fashion and other unsustainable business models as well. I mean, I think it's really important to point out that a lot of the premium brands, a lot of mass-produced luxury is produced on exactly the same production lines as fast fashion.
I know.
So they may be paying a little bit more, you know, maybe an extra 25 cents because there's a little bit more detailing around the pocket or the seams. And it might be slightly better sewn, so it might last a little bit longer. But you're not guaranteeing that the conditions are any better at all. And I mean, the fast fashion model has undoubtedly created a lot of the problems that we see today, but also some of the fast fashion brands are doing really well in terms of our fashion transparency index. So some of the top performers are the fast fashion brands. I mean, we were talking about Eileen Fisher and setting goals, and a lot, or several of the fast fashion brands, you know, are setting ambitious goals, and they're reporting on those goals every year. So, you know, they are the worst offenders, but they are also trying to be a part of the solution. So we are, certainly are seeing some of the fast fashion brands, by no means all of them, leading the way in terms of their social and environmental work. And, you know, they certainly aren't working to reduce the amount they're selling, which is obviously a huge issue. I mean, we have to see systemic change in the whole of the industry, and that has to involve a change in the way in which we we consume. I mean, you're right, in places like Germany, people do consume, you know, probably more mindfully. They certainly don't in the UK on the whole, and it sounds like they don't in the States. So there will be country by country variants, but most of these brands operate globally. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there who do have, you know, a pretty insatiable appetite for cheap clothing, but it's not necessarily the cheapness. So it's certainly not the fastness which is the issue, because, you know, in the past, fast was quite a good thing. Some of these brands are producing, you know, quite quickly because they can have a faster turnaround because they're producing in Europe or quite close to Europe, like Zara. So it's not necessarily the speed of production which is a problem, but it is the speed of consumption.
It just blows me away. I mean, you're absolutely and positively right. So let's go a little bit into, I was very intrigued about your successful ability to engage the producers, the garment workers, the makers of our clothes. And I'm sure I read this on your website that you heard from over 2,600 producers, garment workers, and makers who used Instagram and Twitter to tell the world, hashtag, I made your clothes. And I hope everybody who listens to this show will go to fashionrevolution.org and look at some of these delightful and joyful and engaging pictures. So how did you get to them? Was a question like, how did they know about the Fashion Revolution? Sometimes when you read about their working conditions and their living conditions, but they were on it, like big time.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I remember last year, somebody mentioned on the hashtag I made your clothes on Twitter, and they said this is the most joy a hashtag has given me all year. And it's true. If you look at I made your clothes on, particularly on Instagram, you know, you just see wonderful photographs of producers around the world. You can get Kenyan basket makers, you can get, you know, embroiderers from Ecuador, you can get Panama hat weavers, you can get, you know, just people working in factories around the world, you can get leather workers in the UK. It's a real diversity of small and large. And I think, I mean, a lot of them have obviously been reached through the country coordinators. So we have a network of country coordinators and country teams, and a lot of them have been engaged through that. A lot of these smaller brands do use social media, so they've come across Fashion Revolution on social media. And then, you know, several of the brands, the more responsible brands and some of the larger brands, are taking this opportunity to show that they are transparent, and they're showing the photographs of their factories. So if you look at Gildan, for instance, who is a huge brand in the States and in North America, the US and Canada, and Gildan, towards the end of Fashion Revolution Week, showed a whole series of their different workers in their factories on Twitter, sort of images of them holding up, I made your clothes. So we're seeing people engaging, you know, both the large brands, the small brands, and the producer groups themselves. And, you know, what we want is to be able to show these people's faces, to be able to tell their stories on our blog as well, because we need to give more visibility to the people who make our clothes. We need people to realize that, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of people who have been involved in making just one item of clothing which we're wearing. And if we give them more visibility, then I think there's going to start to be more of a connection between the people who wear the clothes and the people who produce them. I mean, it's very hard to not care about people and the conditions they're working in when you can see a photograph of them.
Exactly. You put a face to it.
When you hear their stories, you talk about their, you know, their dreams and their ambitions and their goals of their children having a better future and sending their children and hearing their children's dreams of, you know, becoming an engineer or a doctor. And you think, this is what these people are working so hard for in these garment factories.
We had an interesting story here that I couldn't wait to share with you, and it was very close to, or maybe even during, Fashion Revolution Week. And it was front page, I believe. I might not be sure about that. But it was about a couple in Tucson that the woman had bought a purse. And in one of the little pockets inside the purse was a letter from a man in China. And I mean, Carrie, I could not make this up. He said, we live in slave labor conditions. We work 6 days a week. you know, I mean, on and on. He just told the whole story, and it got out in the purse. So when you talk about making it real, and the person that wrote the story is a great reporter here, and he talked about fashion revolution and the filthy fashion industry, and I thought, wow, raising awareness right here in our town. It certainly put a face to it. And of course, they didn't know what to do. When you get something like that, what do you do? And I say, you know your farmer, know your fashion chain. It's all part of that, you know, consciousness that I feel encouraged that's, you know, catching on. It's unbelievable. Talk about country coordinators. You mentioned that, but explain to our listeners what the country coordinators do, what their role is, and you have a lot of them. I think over 90.
Yes, probably 100 now. I mean, some are certainly more active than others. Some of them work mostly around Fashion Revolution Week and the sort of weeks leading up to it, but a lot of them are working, you know, all year around, which is what we really need to see. Several of them have formed their own NGOs and not-for-profit organisations as well, so they can start to do their own fundraising and get sponsorship. And, you know, I think it's really important. You know, the countries know their producers, their government, their policies much better than we do. So it's really good to give them some, you know, some autonomy. But at the same time, we have an overview of the whole, you know, the whole process. We give them guidance. We send them the key messages. And, of course, all of the amazing sort of social media statistics and images and photo shoots which they can use. So I think our job very much is to say, well, you know, use this. This is the framework you can use. You know, come to us if you've got any queries. You know, there's a few don't do this and don't do that. But, you know, broadly, we're quite happy for people to have, you know, have their own focus. I mean, in Africa, for instance, the main issue they're facing is all of the secondhand clothing being dumped onto their market, which is destroying the local textile and tailoring industries. So for our African country coordinators, you know, that's the issue. It's the textile waste of Europe and North America, which they really want to address. And they might do that through having a spoken word competition, for instance. You might get sort of poetry and different monologues. So, you know, it's very broad, but we do realise there's different priorities. You know, if it's a textile manufacturing country like Honduras or Bangladesh, then there might be different priorities than, you know, the country team in India or Australia, for instance, Italy or Australia, for instance.
But explain that phenomenon a little bit more when you talk about the dumping of secondhand. What do you mean by that? Go into that a little bit more. The dumping of textiles. You know, so what does that look like?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it looks like a huge problem. I mean, our insatiable appetite for clothing, you know, we think we can just donate these clothes that, you know, we've worn a few times or that, you know, are well worn to a secondhand shop, you know, to a charity shop, Thrift, Goodwill. And I think a lot of people assume that those shops will then resell those clothes, but really only about 10%, estimates say, of that clothing is resold.
You're kidding.
A lot of it, yep, it's a really, really small percentage. I mean, certainly in the UK, I can't imagine the US is that different. Because, you know, they just can't sell that quantity of clothing. So a lot of it is, you know, if it's in really poor quality, it's shredded into rags and it can be used for insulation and lots of other different purposes. But a lot of it is shipped to Central America. If you go to places like Guatemala, there's lots of places called pacas. And I was in Central America last year. And, you know, there's just whole markets with tables and tables and tables of clothing from the US for 50 cents or a dollar. And, of course, you know, people are buying that because it's really cheap. Traditional dress is expensive. Traditional dress in Africa, traditional dress in Guatemala, Peru, you know, it really isn't cheap. It takes time, is laborious to make, you know, months and months sometimes to make, you know, 9 months to weave a shawl which somebody will wear at the wedding, for instance, in Guatemala. So, you know, it's part of the move away from traditional dress as well. But it's also meaning that, you know, even just the basic tailoring industries making more Western clothes in those countries can't compete. You can't compete with clothing, you know, being sold for 50 cents, being sold for a dollar in those countries. So some of the African countries are talking about bringing in bans on secondhand clothing, and places like Tanzania, have certainly said they're going to ban secondhand clothing. But they're now having to rush to train more tailors, more artisans, because they don't have enough people with those skills anymore to start to rebuild their own industry. So it's caused a lot of problems in developing countries, which most of us aren't aware of. Because we can't see it, it's very easy to ignore the problem of textile waste, if you can't see those mounds and mounds and mounds of clothing which, just being discarded every day.
And to take a deeper cut on that, I am almost speechless, which is not a good thing since I'm having to, ask a lot of the questions. I don't want to lose my voice here, but I had the pleasure of meeting one of the producers of a movie called Poverty, Inc., and the basic message is the only way to end poverty is to help people get out of it. And this was a big part of the movie, that even in the philanthropic or donation, or we care so much about this tragedy that happened, the tsunami and the earthquake and whatever, the United States just donates. I know what I do. I empty out my T-shirt drawer. And all the T-shirts go over, and they interviewed people in Africa, in Haiti, in some really highly impacted areas who said that decimates and destroys any opportunities that we have in the clothing manufacturing arena, which is one that's ever present. So I didn't really ever think about that, because if you're in a market selling used clothing for 50 cents that you got from the United States, I'm going to guess it's not a way out of poverty and to create sustainable, livable working conditions for the people that live in those countries. That's really blows me away.
Yeah, no, not at all. And actually in places like Haiti, as well as dumping the secondhand clothing on them after the earthquake, also a lot of the money raised for donations actually went in to setting up more sweatshops, which is just shocking. And having a job is really important, but just any job, it doesn't preclude having a good job, a decent job. There's plenty of factories, Share Hope Haiti, Industrial Revolution II, which were set up by the actor Matt Damon. And there's plenty of people who have shown that it is possible to be just as productive and to pay people a living wage and to give them, free medical attention, to provide them with an affordable lunchtime meal. Because in Haiti, a lot of people pay a really substantial amount of money every day to eat their lunchtime meal. They're all indebted to, their friends, their neighbours, and having to borrow money because they really cannot make ends meet on the money they're earning. And we give them money, and someone thinks it's a really great idea to set up a free trade zone with more sweatshops and thinks this is a way out of poverty. Poverty has to be decent jobs, and decent jobs aren't that hard. One of the statistics that always kind of makes, I think, a lot of people think twice is that it would take only about an extra maybe 35 to 40 cents on an item of clothing made in Bangladesh for the producer to have received a living wage and to make sure that all of the buildings met the fire and building regulation standards. And that really isn't a lot of money to pay on top of the cost of a garment, to make sure that somebody hasn't suffered or died for the clothing you're buying. A lot of people will go shopping and then they might go and spend, a couple of dollars on a coffee, and they've bought four items of clothing. So I think a lot of people would pay that fraction extra if they knew that the producer was receiving a living wage.
They would pay it without even knowing it. Like, who would care? It's not a budget item that would even show up. $5, big difference. 35 to 40 cents, nobody would even notice. That is an absolutely and positively shocking, pejorative statistic. Seriously, I wrote every word of that down because it's a great, it's a great line for Twitter that we can use when we're promoting the show, but it's really an important message. And I, for one, there's not a person I know in my world that wouldn't be willing to pay a little bit more. There's a lot of issues like that where it would take a little bit to help a lot. And one of my favorite expressions lately is a rising tide, what is it, raises all ships. And this is the case, because if you do that, everybody wins. The people in poverty win. It's a stronger community. Kids get educated, therefore less likely to be in poverty and need to be supported. So that's pretty exciting to put that out there. So we are up on another break, and I cannot wait for the last segment of the show. Joining us is Carrie Summers. She is the founder and global operations director for Fashion Revolution. When we come back, more about the Fashion Transparency Index. It will blow your mind. Please stay here with me.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for being here. Joining us for this hour is Carrie Summers. Carrie is the founder and global operations director for Fashion Revolution in the UK. Fashion Revolution believes in a fashion industry that values people, the environment, creativity, and profit in equal measures. Imagine that. They are literally leading a global fashion revolution to make sure we all move in that direction and as quickly as possible. Carrie, what a delight it is to have you here sharing your passion and the impact you've made already in a very short time. So let's talk about the Fashion Transparency Index. And I want to remind everybody, the Fashion Revolution website is fashionrevolution.org. And there are two items of interest for me to talk about here. And I would also like to mention that you can download these. They're free and available to anyone that's interested in reading them. I love that. So there's one, the Fashion Transparency Index, that ranks 40 of the biggest global fashion companies according to their levels of transparency based on a questionnaire and publicly available information about supply chain issues that was published in April of 2016. And then there is the ranking of the levels of transparency of 100 of the biggest global fashion companies. And Carrie, you want to tell us a little bit about each of them and then go into detail? I mean, this is an amazing, rigorous, thorough work of, man, a lot of labor and love went into this. I kept, you know, I was telling Kelly, my show producer, I fell asleep at my computer three times last night, which I shouldn't admit on a national podcast, but I kept wanting to read more. It was like it grabbed my soul, because there's so much depth to what you did. So talk about it, brag about it, tell us about this amazing publication.
Yeah, I mean, there really is so much there. The 2017 Fashion Transparency Index obviously sort of builds on the work we did in 2016, but we did a lot more research on the sort of methodology initially. So we consulted a lot of industry experts and academics, and they sort of had a lot of input, people like Industrial, Global Union. So, you know, what's the information that brands really need to be disclosing, not just about their policies and practices, because brands are pretty good at talking about their policies and having those in place, but what, you know, what impact are they actually having? How are they reporting on their progress towards those goals? And we were just talking before the break about the living wages. And when you look at the policies, 34 out of 100 brands have made a public commitment to paying a living wage throughout their supply chain. And you think, well, you know, that's pretty good. That's a third of brands who are, you know, I mean, it's not that great, but a third of brands have made a public commitment to paying a living wage to garment workers. But actually, only four of those brands, that's H&M, Marks and Spencer's, New Look and Puma are reporting on any progress towards achieving this aim. So how do we know whether that's, you know, that policy is really being put into practice? How do we know when garment workers are going to get a living wage? How do we know if the brands, you know, are looking at how they're going to achieve that living wage? Are they going to be making efficiencies? Are they going to be training the workers to try and improve their productivity? Because that's one way to get them towards a living wage. They're not really disclosing how they're achieving it and how they're likely to be achieving it. So we need to see more reporting on the activities, on the progress, so that we know that brands really are doing, you know, what they say they're doing in their policies.
And I just want to read one paragraph, because it just, this is what made me maybe read a couple of, you know, more. The average score, this is in the executive summary of the 2017 Fashion Transparency Index, the average score for all brands in Fashion Transparency Index is 49 out of 250, roughly 20% of all possible points. Adidas and Reebok achieved the highest score, which was really, it's like, what? Of 121.5 out of 250, so 49% of total possible points, followed by Marks and Spencer with 120 points and H&M with 119.5 points, 48% of total possible points. Was that like depressing or encouraging or exciting or all of the above? I mean, that's not great.
It's not great, but, you know, it was pretty tough. There was categories where brands really weren't scoring at all. I mean, for instance, nobody is talking about transparency of their raw materials. So there's no maps of where materials are coming from. So no brand scored, you know, they might have scored 1 point for saying that they were actually starting to work towards traceability in their leather or cotton, for instance, but there was no mapping of that tier of their supply chain, of their raw material suppliers. So, you know, it was deliberately difficult because these are things that we know that brands should be doing, that they've got to be doing to make, you know, a cleaner, more sustainable fashion industry, but they're not doing. And we had spotlight issues this year as well, which are issues that, you know, we think are really important to bring about change in the fashion industry. And one of them was that elephant in the room, you know, consumption. What are you doing to try to reduce your consumption? And we found that only a couple of brands were offering any kind of a repair service, for instance. You know, so that's certainly something we'd like to see more of, so that your clothing does last for longer.
And talk about there, I thought it was also interesting about three brands, Burberry, Gucci, and Levi Strauss. I mean, a brand that's affordable to the masses, are promoting repair services. Talk a little bit about that. That was very interesting to me.
Yes, it is. I mean, you know, like I was saying, we've got to make our clothes last for longer. We've got to start to love our clothes and learn how to repair them, whether that's mending them ourselves, whether that's darning, whether that's taking our shoes to the cobbler or taking them back to the brands. You know, we need our clothes to last for longer, and we want brands to be able to offer that kind of service. I mean, some of the other smaller brands do as well, people like Patagonia, who weren't in the top 100 brands. You know, there are other brands offering those services as well outside of the top 100 brands. But we thought that was really important, you know, as a way to stop the, you know, the endless consumption that, you know, if a seam starts to come apart, that you will just discard it and go out and buy a replacement jacket or another pair of shoes. So, yeah, repairing and, you know, finding a way to love the clothes that you own. We started a new hashtag during Fashion Revolution Week, which was Loved Clothes Last. And we think this is really important. We're actually starting to address the issue of waste much more. And, you know, teaching people that you can get some wonderful clothes from vintage shops, or you can do a clothes swap with your friends. There's plenty of ways of replenishing a wardrobe without necessarily buying new clothing. So start to fall back in love again with some of the clothes that are buried in the back of your wardrobe.
And I can tell you, for my experience and the evolution of Mrs. Green, I am a Goodwill shopper and I find treasures there. And in our particular region, there's a lot of effort put into not putting anything in the landfill. And I've, you know, toured their facilities. I see what they do. And, you know, everything from selling a bag of clothing for, you know, 5 pounds of clothing for a dollar and rags and all of those things. But the other good news on the flip side of that is, and I want people to really, you know, I'm moving on to another subject, but vintage, when I was in L.A. with my daughter, we spent 3.5 hours, much to my husband's dismay, who is a saint, in a store called Wasteland. And you talk about high-end, beautiful, and affordable secondhand clothings. I mean, I made a killing for a fraction of the cost. I mean, there were brands that my daughter knows because she's hip and saying, you know, Mom, you have to try this on. But it was delightful, and I felt so noble. It's like I'm not really, no one was harmed in the making of this secondhand. at least I wasn't responsible for that purchase. So in the area of good news, one of the things that made me the happiest is when you wrote about disclosure and the increasing number of brands. And let's face it, there are big brands in our country: Banana Republic, Gap, and Old Navy, all owned by Gap. They scored the highest in traceability, and I think they deserve a shout out for that. It means they're moving in the right direction. Do you agree?
Yes, definitely. And we've really seen an avalanche of brands over the last 12 months publishing their supply chains. People like, you know, ASOS, who again are a huge brand, Benetton, C&A, you know, Gap, as you mentioned, also the VF Corporation, who own Wranglers, The North Face, a lot of other brands as well. So we're seeing more and more brands starting to publish at least their first-tier factories where their clothes are sewn together. So, you know, they do deserve to, you know, be encouraged to go further. I mean, you know, it's great that they've done this. It's a really, really important first step. But, you know, then I think it's really important that they don't become complacent at that they keep on updating those lists, and they really start to work towards disclosing, well, where are those textiles coming from? Where's that cotton coming from? I mean, a lot of cotton comes from Uzbekistan. It's one of the biggest cotton-producing countries. And yet that cotton is routinely labelled made in Bangladesh. The brands aren't going to know where that cotton comes from. They're not going to know whether that's been picked using slave labour.
Right.
Because a lot of people, a lot of the population are forced by the government to leave their employment and go out into the cotton fields and pick the cotton harvest every year. And, you know, we can be supporting slavery with the next cotton garment that we buy. And, you know, we need to know that isn't happening. And that's why brands need to do the research so that we can be sure that our cotton is free of slavery.
And I will tell you this. I mean, you can tell I did my homework on this one, kiddo. It's like, wow. So one of the wow slides for me, or the pages in the report, was the light, when you had transparency and the light shining down. And it starts with fair trade. It's all of the components that you look at when you're talking about public disclosure and brand policies and all of those things. And it includes fair trade, well-being, living wages, empowerment, gender equality, business accountability, sustainable livelihoods, good working conditions, environmental sustainability. And at the bottom, it says a fairer, safer, cleaner fashion industry. And it's like, whoever did that graphic should win an award, because it's like, if you want to know how complex it is in one graphic, here it is. And I guess my question is, transparency isn't the end game. It's a means to change. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Exactly. I mean, transparency certainly isn't the end goal, but transparency helps to reveal the structures that are in place so that we can reveal how to bring about change. We want to see structural, systemic change. So transparency does shine a light on all of those issues. And once we can see what those issues are, once we can see what the problems are, we can start to fix them. We can start to hold those brands accountable. We can start to encourage them to change. So yes, I mean, transparency isn't the end game. We've got to see a radical paradigm shift. We've got to see a fashion revolution. And we've got to change the way in which we produce and consume clothing. And you know, this will need a lot of different solutions. But we, you know, we believe that if we do shine a light of transparency, that we can start to address all of these issues. And we really hope that through the Fashion Transparency Index, you know, that brands will realise that they need to. And it's no good having a policy on gender equality. You actually need to do something about it to make sure that women are receiving the same wages as men throughout the supply chain. You know, looking at business accountability, where is the, you know, the governance embedded? You know, who is responsible at board level? Is that information published? You know, some brands do really well at sharing. M&S in particular scored 100% on this, so it is possible to disclose who in the company is responsible. You know, the buck stops with this person. They are responsible for ensuring sustainability throughout the company. So yes, you know, transparency will start to shine a light, and it will show where brands aren't being transparent as well. You know, some brands are revealing absolutely nothing. So we've got no idea even what their policies are, let alone their practices.
Right, right. You know, you also talked about there are three important things that you recognize, and I just have to tell a little very short funny story about when I was doing the research. I kept correcting the way that things were spelled, saying, oh, that's misspelled, and then realizing that it is the English language that we emulate and have we have copied, and that you're spelling it right. We've just changed recognize to a Z instead of an S. So I thought that very American of me and said, stop doing that. This is the way it was spelled in the very beginning, and we changed it. So I was having a little opportunity to laugh at myself there. But to achieve change, you articulated three important things. It's a process, more information is needed, and inclusivity is key. Can you just go into each one of those a little bit more? It's a process. That is so clear.
Yes, it is. I mean, change, you know, like I was saying, it's not going to happen overnight. You know, brands have to start to take those small incremental steps. You know, brands have to set goals. They can't report on progress towards achieving those goals if they haven't even set any goals to start with. So it is a process. It needs to be embedded throughout the organisation. So we need to see brands starting on that process if they're not already there. And we need to start to see them disclosing what that process is. I mean, a lot of brands talk about the audit process, for instance, but they don't disclose what the results are of those audits. So we don't know how many of their factories have, you know, are in remediation. We don't know whether, you know, how many factories need improvement. All they often do is talk about this is the audit process. So we've really got to know more than just what the process is. We've got to know, you know, what are the results? What are you doing about it? If a factory's failing, what do you do? Do you stop working with them? Do you give them a certain period of time to improve?
Right, right.
So that's, you know, that's all part of the long process that we need to be able to see.
And talk about walking the walk, or whatever that expression is. I think I get it wrong every time. It's walking the walk or walking the talk or whatever. But you practice what you preach, because I also loved the page that when you changed the methodology, it was full disclosure and transparency. And you talked about what different metrics, the revisions you made. I loved that the Sustainable Development Goals from the United Nations were included. So there were many things. And I, you know, I'm very, very, very sad to say we have about 2 minutes left. And you get the last word, but I want to encourage everyone, just go to fashionrevolution.org. You will be able to connect to all of their social media platforms. Spend some time reading the Fashion Transparency Index. It's not boring. It's anything but, and then you can become a more engaged and conscious consumer. And just want to do a quick shout out. June 1st, Larry Weagle, A Show for the Birds, indeed, the Raptor program in the Southwest from Tucson Electric Power. And our national show on June 6th is Michael Brune. Mike Brune, Join the Fight, Protect Our Planet. He is the head of the Sierra Club for the United States. Do you have a final word, my friend, Carrie? I can't wait to meet you, and I'm putting that out there. What a change agent you and your amazing team are. What do you want to say the call to action is?
Well, the call to action has to be that question, who made my clothes?
Yes.
You know, everyone can do that, even if you don't use social media. You can ask the shop assistant. If they don't know, they're going to ask their supervisor, and they'll start to say, well, all these people are asking who made my clothes. We better start asking our managers. So everyone can ask that question, who made my clothes? It's really not difficult, and you might be surprised at the answers you get. And if you don't get answers, keep on asking the questions, because brands need to disclose that information to the people who love buying their clothes.
You have made it a delightful hour, a wonderful final call to action. Everybody who did make your clothes, make it a great green day, and thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's world.